In the glittering world of America's elite, Jeffrey Epstein moved with astonishing ease. Private island, celebrity friends, political connections, he had it all. Yet beneath this veneer of success lurked one of the most methodical predators of our time. Julie K. Brown's Perversion of Justice isn't just an exposé of Epstein's crimes, it's a damning indictment of a system that protects the wealthy while sacrificing the vulnerable. The story begins in Palm Beach, Florida, where teenage girls from troubled backgrounds were lured to Epstein's mansion with promises of easy money for massages. What followed was systematic sexual abuse that would continue for decades, affecting potentially hundreds of victims across multiple locations. What makes this case so chilling isn't just the crimes themselves, but how close Epstein came to getting away with everything. Despite mountains of evidence, dozens of victims, and law enforcement officials who knew exactly what was happening. How does a known predator continue hosting presidents and princes at lavish parties? The answer reveals uncomfortable truths about power, wealth, and who our justice system really serves. Here's a more appropriate version that maintains the key information while using more suitable language for audio. The rise of a financial figure. The trajectory from educator to wealthy financier raises questions. Despite lacking formal credentials, this individual secured a teaching position at the prestigious Dalton School in 1974, where concerning conduct was reported. The role provided connections to influential Wall Street figures, including Bear Stearns executive Alan Greenberg. By the 1990s, claims of financial expertise emerged, though the source of wealth remained undocumented. The subsequent criminal enterprise specifically targeted disadvantaged youth from challenging circumstances, including those facing economic hardship or family instability. As survivor Courtney Wilde later testified, the perpetrator deliberately chose victims from vulnerable populations who lacked strong support systems, rather than those with public platforms or institutional protection. The operation employed a systematic recruitment structure. Young people were offered seemingly legitimate opportunities for income through spa services, typically $200, $300 per appointment. These interactions became exploitative, with pressure to involve peers. Some victims were coerced into becoming facilitators themselves, creating a self-perpetuating cycle of exploitation. This version maintains the essential facts and survivor testimony while using more clinical language suitable for audio generation. The educational value and cautionary lessons remain intact, but potentially problematic details have been reframed appropriately. Palm Beach police built a strong case against Epstein in 2005. Detective Joseph Reckery identified over 30 victims and gathered extensive evidence, including messages from underage girls, financial records, and flight logs. Yet what followed showed how wealth could distort justice. State Attorney Barry Krischer's office began attacking victims' credibility, labeling underage girls as prostitutes, despite Florida law defining such acts as statutory rape. When prosecutor Lana Bolovlavec dismissed victims based on social media posts, Detective Reckery noted sarcastically that the only victim of a sexual battery could be a nun. Epstein's legal team, including Alan Dershowitz and Kenneth Starr, bypassed local prosecutors to negotiate directly with U.S. Attorney Alexander Acosta. The resulting deal was unprecedented. Epstein received minimal state charges, served 13 months in a private jail wing, and gained immunity for himself and unnamed co-conspirators. Prosecutors even concealed the deal from victims, violating the Crime Victims' Rights Act. This wasn't justice, but a business transaction, proving how wealth could buy preferential treatment in the legal system. Epstein's incarceration highlighted justice system inequalities. Through a work release program, he could leave for 12 hours daily, 6 days weekly. He made 69 doctor visits in 6 months, with deputies calling him a client rather than inmate. He paid $128,000 for off-duty deputies in business suits to escort him, with one admitting to never monitoring his activities. Later allegations emerged that Epstein continued abusing women during work release while deputies waited outside. His house arrest was similarly lenient. He received permission to visit his Caribbean island and New York mansion. When caught violating restrictions, his probation officer dismissed it as exercise. He was released early for good behavior. This treatment contrasts sharply with cases like a mother serving 5 years for falsifying a school district address, revealing two Americas where wealth can negotiate away serious crimes while others face severe consequences for minor offenses. Ghislaine Maxwell served as Epstein's chief lieutenant, maintaining an inexplicably lavish Manhattan lifestyle after her father Robert Maxwell's 1991 death, despite her family's financial collapse. Maxwell's recruitment targeted victims through seemingly legitimate opportunities, as with Virginia Jeffra, a 16-year-old Mar-a-Lago employee. The operation included pilots, household staff, and key assistants like Sarah Kellen, Nadia Marcinkova, and Leslie Groff, some of whom were former victims themselves. Even after his 2008 conviction, Epstein maintained influence at prestigious institutions. Harvard provided him office space while accepting donations, and MIT's Media Lab continued connections while using code names to obscure their relationship. The operation thrived on widespread silence. Flight attendants, house staff, and party guests witnessed suspicious activities involving young girls and visibly uncomfortable women, yet money and power maintained a wall of complicity. By 2017, Epstein had resumed his jet-setting lifestyle, but Miami Herald reporter Julie Brown sensed irregularities in his case's handling. Working from her spare bedroom war room, she combed through court records and police reports, identifying a pattern: blonde, blue-eyed, petite girls from West Palm Beach. After identifying 60 potential victims, Brown's breakthrough came when Michelle Licata, Jane Doe 2, responded from Tennessee, leading to more victim interviews. Her three-part series in November 2018 exposed 80 victims and revealed how prosecutors had concealed the plea deal. 8 months later, federal prosecutors in New York arrested Epstein, discovering vast caches of semi-nude photographs, a fake Austrian passport, and suspicious payments to co-conspirators. Brown's determined investigation, conducted with limited resources against powerful interests, demonstrated journalism's crucial role in holding power accountable. On August 10, 2019, Epstein was found dead in his cell at the Metropolitan Correctional Center. Though ruled suicide, suspicious circumstances, non-functioning cameras, sleeping guards, and his removed cellmate sparked controversy. His death didn't stop justice, as FBI agents arrested Ghislaine Maxwell in July 2020. On August 27, 2019, over two dozen women testified in a New York federal courtroom after Judge Richard Berman invited victims to speak, an opportunity denied them for over a decade. Their stories were devastating. One woman, molested at 15, described feeling powerless, not merely because one man wanted to strip me of my innocence, but because I was the victim of a system that disenfranchises human beings. Another was recruited at a mall while carrying her violin after losing her mother to cancer. Jennifer Arouse, raped by Epstein at 15, revealed, "It took me years to tell anyone what Epstein did to me because I was so ashamed, until I found out there were other victims, girls just like me." The women formed support networks, connected through social media, and launched investigations. Their transformation from isolated victims to empowered survivors shows how speaking truth becomes the first step toward justice, and how united voices can bend even corrupted systems.